Good morning. The chance to swim with dolphins is a big attraction for visitors to Hawaii, but could the practice come to an end with proposed new rules? We'll talk with NOAA's Ann Garrett. Meanwhile, the USGS recently surveyed Kauai's Napali coast to figure out what's causing black band coral disease. Environmental microbiologist Christine Kellogg looks at the preliminary findings and what's next. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Actors Group is mounting a timely production, Gore Vidal's The Best Man, a look at presidential politics from the days when party nominating conventions were not a foregone conclusion. And a community garden needs many hands to make light work. We'll hear from Hali'i Maile Community Garden's Lori Feroli.
A garden, the theater, and ocean life. Today on The Conversation, now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Coral has always been in a parlous state, at least for many decades now, hasn't it?
And we've been talking about this for years as we've had different diseases move through, and the last couple of years been wrapped up in what's been happening with coral bleaching and ocean acidification and seeing Montipora move through Hawaii, now black band disease a few years ago that was noted by Greta Abbey, one of the UH researchers that we talk to frequently. And now there's a study that says there could be some reasons behind that.
Wouldn't be surprised.
Well, for several years, we've heard from UH researchers that runoff and underwater discharge could be contributing factors in the death of corals around Hawaii. This month, the U.S. Geological Survey studied Kauai's Napali coast to gather evidence why Kauai corals have been suffering from black band disease. And while it's not, at the moment at least, conclusive, researchers are looking at groundwater discharge as at least one of the reasons. Christina Kellogg is an environmental microbiologist with the St. Petersburg Coastal and Marine Science Center. She participated in the study, and she joins us now by phone from St. Petersburg, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you. We've talked with UH researcher Greta Abbey, as we noted a moment ago, for quite some time. She was one of the researchers who noted the black band coral disease on Kauai's North Shore. As you participated in this study and know that, you know, we don't have findings per se, what is it that you found to be, you know, a reasonably good, apparent reason for why we're seeing black band?
So, hey, Greta and I have known each other for a long time. In fact, I was lucky to have one of her students, Chris Runyon, come over and work with me while we were in Kauai. So we were specifically out looking for incidents of black band disease and unfortunately did find some. The USGS sort of had several teams working together on this project. So we had a submarine groundwater team who was looking to see if they could confirm that there was groundwater discharge in the Makua area where we were working. And in fact, by taking salinity measurements right along the shore at low tide, which is when groundwater's influence is most visible, they were able to find several pockets of low salinity right along the shore there, and then further confirmed it was groundwater and not just surface runoff by testing it for radon, which lets you know it's been underwater for some period of time. So we could at least confirm there was groundwater discharge along that part of the shore. And then another team, who I'll call sort of the oceanography team, had put out current meters and was using drifters both to sort of look at the direction and the speed of the water flow in and around the Makua area on the reef further out and close to shore. And they were finding from the drifters that the water does move more slowly along certain parts right along the shore, which would suggest a situation where if you did have contaminants coming out in the groundwater, they would be on the reef, that shallow close to shore part of reef, longer than, say, the outer reef, because the water isn't flushing through that area quite as quickly. And then I was sort of team microbiology, and so I took water samples to look for bacterial load and to look at nutrients. And, of course, those haven't been processed yet, but I'll look to see whether there were nutrients like nitrates, ammonia, phosphates, close to shore, versus what the concentrations would be out on the reef next to where the black band disease was occurring. And then also I took larger water samples that I'll look at for using metagenomics, which is sort of a newish method where I'll pull all the genes of all the microbes in those water samples out and then look at them. And this technique hasn't really been used in this way before that I'm aware of, but the idea is that I can look in those genes and see, are there nutrient cycles? Say there's a lot of genes that look like they're processing nitrates. Well, mm-hmm. then that might suggest nitrates were driving what we're seeing. Or if there's a lot of genes that cause virulence or infection, that might suggest that something in the groundwater is enhancing bacteria that are causing some of the diseases. And so it's an open-ended sort of method, so I don't know exactly what I'm going to find, but those are the types of connections I'm looking to possibly be able to make so that we could somehow tie these environmental stressors that may be present in the groundwater to the actual disease.
Christina, when do you anticipate doing some of this? Because it seems from what you've just explained that that would be sort of, you know, linchpin information that would send us off in a direction of far more certainty.
Right. So, again, literally, we just got back from being in Kauai about a week ago, and so within the next couple of months, I'll be able to get those nutrient samples processed and have that information, probably, again, another month or so for me to get the sequences from the DNA, and then another couple months for me to then take the millions of sequences I'll get back and actually do the analysis to sort of start pulling that information out.
Does this method that you've just outlined have also applicability with other diseases and other ways of being able to determine, you know, human factors in ruining our corals?
I would say yes. I mean, truthfully, metagenomics is mostly being used more in clinical settings, and so I'm trying to take things that are being used for, say, to study the human microbiome and pull them out into the environment and use them in similar ways.
We're often told, and certainly Greta Abbey, your friend, has told us many times that the human, you know, whatever, you know, the humans can do to lessen the impact should be done regardless of what's happening with the, you know, the surveys that are ongoing. Did you find any evidence that there's been, you know, a lessening of human impact there as you were studying the coast? You've just been there.
I can't say that there would be a lessening because I don't have a baseline for before. Certainly, some of the analyses I did while I was on the island. So while we were sampling, I was plating to look for fecal indicator bacteria and did not see them, which suggests the water was clean from that aspect. And I was plating for Vibrios, which is another type of bacteria it's naturally a marine bacteria, but it's sometimes used as an indicator of nutrients because it's weedy. And so if you have more nutrients, you may see more of them. And there weren't terribly many of those either. So from those two simple metrics, the water seemed fairly clean.
Are there stressors that corals can feel from, you know, clean water? I mean, you sort of alluded to that a little while ago.
I mean, of course, you know, just because I plated for two types of bacteria and didn't see them doesn't mean there aren't other types of bacteria. Truthfully, the microorganisms that cause black band disease are present on the reef all the time. We already know that. So really what I'm looking for is something else that would cause them to suddenly grow out of control, which is why I was targeting looking at nutrients, but potentially trying to figure out if it's not nutrients, could it be something else in the groundwater that's triggering that reaction?
And that sounds similar to what we hear about people, that, you know, there's certain bacterium that we carry on us all the time, but if something triggers it to move in a certain direction or not, then you may get a rash or, you know, skin discolorations, those kinds of things.
Exactly. But as you said, you know, we're trying to determine what things might be driving this because then it gives management a way to control that. If you know this is an issue, well, then you can immediately try and remove or reduce that stressor to give the corals a chance to adapt and get past it. But if you can do something before you have data to put you in a direction, anything that tries to relieve some of that stress helps.
What about any sort of, you know, residual bits and pieces of pharmaceuticals in any sort of way? I mean, that people dump things all the time.
Right. And so none of the work we were doing would specifically target that. We certainly heard that that's an interest in the community to look at contaminants, say, from personal care products or other things like that that might be leaching through the groundwater. And that's definitely on our radar, is if we determined that we needed to come do follow-up studies, that would potentially be an area of targeting, because it is something people are asking about.
Well, stay in touch with us. We want to hear what happens as you continue this study.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for the time this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Christina Kellogg is a microbiologist with the USGS at St. Petersburg Coastal Marine Science Center in St. Petersburg, Florida. She participated in the study on Kauai. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, a behind-the-scenes drama of political intrigue comes to the Actors Group. But first, your backyard quiz.
Today's backyard quiz takes us to a small Hawaii farm with a unique product. Located on the Big Island, our mystery ranch is a micro farm that specializes in producing wool. But you won't find a large flock of sheep being sheared there. Instead, the wool produced here comes from rabbits. That's right. Rabbits, English Angora rabbits, to be precise. These bunnies grow an almost comically thick coat of fur that can be shorn 3 or 4 times a year, just like sheep. For today's quiz, we want to know, what is the name of this Hawaii farm that specializes in Angora rabbits? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Lisa Maruyama from the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Today's Democratic and Republican nominating conventions are carefully stage-managed affairs. But back in 1960, when Gore Vidal wrote his play The Best Man, they were an anything-goes proposition with the possibility of sudden shifts of momentum that could make or break a nominee. The nomination is up for grabs in his play, and its Hawaii premiere production is an opportunity to get an insider's view of the rough and tumble that goes on behind the scenes. David Farmer is an actor in the production. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Chris. Good to see you.
This is, among many other things, a play by somebody who had a really kind of insider's view of the characters.
Both on the political level as well as the personal level, absolutely.
Yeah. And back in 1960, the players were people like John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Adlai Stevenson,
Estes Kiefhoffer. Yep. And it's interesting, too, because the play is set in 1960. He wrote it before the 1960 actual convention, mm-hmm. but it's really patterned after the 1948 convention, which was the Democratic convention held in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. which is where the play is set. Mm-hmm. So he's in over 3 days, because it used back in that time it was a 3-day convention.
And in those days, a fiery speech, a key endorsement, could suddenly give you a nominee that you was nobody special a week earlier,
That's right. There is a line, an exchange with my character and Senator Carlin about, gee, he's saying, I wish it would be an open convention. And my character says, well, they're never that open.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a much more free, certainly compared to what we've seen this year.
Well, it's ironic because the 60 convention that followed the production of this play was pretty much of a free-for-all.
That's correct, yeah. It was a squeaker. It was really a squeaker, as was the general election.
So who's your character in the play, and who are the players?
The major players, this is an ensemble piece. There's 13 people in the cast, reporters, delegates, mm-hmm. and it's a very tight, good working together kind of group. The major players are the ex-president, who's kind of patterned after Truman, mm-hmm. Art Hochstadter. My character is William Russell, who's patterned after Adlai Stevenson.
Mm-hmm.
A liberal hope. Yes, the liberal
kind of
hope.
A white knight of the time.
Exactly. In fact, he characterizes himself as the angel of light, you know. And then his opponent is a sort of a working class. Because my character is Harvard, Groton, you know, the whole born to the manor. And Joe Cantwell, the opponent, is a college, work his way through college school, state mm-hmm. college kind of guy, who's very sort of an amalgam of McCarthy, RFK.
The young Bobby Kennedy.
Young Bobby Kennedy, ruthless, anything that works is the motto. There's no value system. There's a big confrontation between these two towards the end of the play, mm-hmm. in which all of these value clashes come out. So those are the three major. There, each of us have wives. Each of us have our things in the closet that each of us are contemplating using against each other. In mm-hmm. the case of my character has a sort of a philanderer. A profile, mm-hmm. And also had a nervous breakdown, which in that period of time that was considered to be a problem, and the aspersion on the my opponent is that he has basically a court-martial history, which basically raised his sexual persuasion, mm-hmm. At issue, and whether or not it's going to be used, either candidate's going to use these things. So that's the whole struggle, and then getting the ex-president's endorsement is the big play, because he's a popular president. He's again, it's fiction. Vidal many times stated that it was not these were not portraits of these players, but simply the flavor of them.
Sure,
and so it's a fascinating character study, but also a fascinating story.
In something like this, David, the truth is really in the atmosphere rather than in the specific details.
Exactly.
And, right. And that's the honesty of the play, is that what these guys are like when the doors are closed and nobody's listening.
That's correct. And there's sort of layers to it as well, because there are the play opens up with a press conference, so that's the most public, the most opportunity.
What you're supposed to hear.
BS, that level. And then all the way down to very private interactions between our respective wives. And because the issue with my character's marriage is because of this philandering, they've had a very separation, period of separation, and for political reasons, they're getting back together. And the development, though, of the marriage as it goes through is another human strand. It's human beings, and that's really what Vidal really was about, and is stated in various interviews, is that. Look, this is not cardboard cutouts of these characters. This is about human beings, and warts and all, which is actually a line for the play.
But there's a fascination in popular culture with these kind of behind the scenes stories, in part I think because we know that what we're presented with is so carefully stage
scripted
managed.
And yes, exactly, and that there is really another story, a backstory, and that's part of the fun of the piece was originally done in 1960, and what's interesting, the actors who have played my role, the original production, Melvin Douglas played my role. A younger Melvin Douglas, but you know,
the model of rectitude of his time.
Absolutely. And then in the film, which was done 4 years later, Henry Fonda.
Again.
A 2000, year 2000 revival, Spalding Gray played him. And in this most recent revival, a couple of years ago, John Larroquette. Now, I defy you of the four to say which, but it illustrates, though, the flexibility.
Yes,
of the character filling in the human part of it is as much variety as those four actors represent.
Sure,
yeah.
Each one of them adept, and the character himself being very adept at presenting a public face.
Yes,
but having a very different one. You know that all these guys, the principals, are used to doing this dance.
Absolutely,
aren't they?
Absolutely, and with various levels of comfort or discomfort doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Adlai was famously uncomfortable with the sham of politics,
yes,
which some would say is the reason he never became president of the United States. Right,
right. Right. And that discomfort is definitely incorporated in my character as well.
So do you sort of take some of your own knowledge of the real life people.
Absolutely. And also, you know, as you know, we were talking before, Vidal was not on my map in terms of the period that he was writing, but as a result of going deeper into his writing, he's an amazing voice, and finding his voice was basically the new discovery for me.
Yeah,
you know, because he's a wonderful writer, beautiful writer.
Well, it sounds like a terrific production, David. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
David Farmer is in the Actors Group production of Gore Vidal's The Best Man, which runs from September 2nd to the 25th at the Dole Cannery Theater. It's a Hawaii premiere, and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
It costs $9.15 to run Hawaii Public Radio statewide network every minute of every day. That comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand balancing a budget, and we are infinitely grateful for their support. Rivers Blake of Honolulu, Dawn Suter of Kailua, and Suzanne Fraser of Hilo. If HPR adds quality to your life, please become a member at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's open every minute of every day.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, working to protect and manage Oahu's drinking water resources for life. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
Next week will be a big one for environmentalists. The International Union of Conservation of Nature World Conservation Congress comes to Hawaii and in the U.S. for the very first time. And it could herald President Obama's decision over the expansion of the Papahānaumokuakea National Marine Monument. Meanwhile, both sides of the argument continue to trade fighting words. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with an update to this reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Yeah, the battle continues. We've seen ads. We've seen a lot of finger pointing. We've seen a lot of, you know, reasoning on both sides. But what led, you know, the Pew group to become involved and create an ad?
Well, you know, they have their fingers in a lot of different things. The Pew Charitable Trust, a very active group. And at least one critic of the organization, Peter Apo, as you know, he's an OHA trustee. He, I should also disclose, he's a contributor to Civil Beat. He writes a column for us. But Peter Apo is actually critical of the expansion. He thinks it's going to hurt fishermen, and he is suspicious of Pew's involvement. They are a primary sponsor of these ads that are running, and if you haven't seen them, they're kind of hard to miss. They're 30-second spots on TV and in cable. And basically, there are people that are speaking out of why it's a good idea to preserve the monument, that it's good for Native Hawaiian culture, it's good for preserving fish stocks. Who knows? There's even new species as yet undiscovered. But on the other side is the fishermen, and they've run their own ads saying, well, basically, if you expand this monument, and by the way, we're looking at a fourfold expansion, something like 600,000 square miles there, and we call this the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, right? Well, if that happens, they warn, you're not going to be able to eat any more fresh local fish.
Right, but didn't we talk about that a little, you know, earlier this summer, that that seemed to be rather disingenuous?
Right, that's exactly the case, and this ad is out to counter that, to get across the point of view that, in fact, this is a good thing to do, but really what you have is dueling ads that are not subject to state and federal campaign finance disclosures. So even though we found out that Pew is involved in funding the Expand Papahanao Mokua Kea effort, there's a lot of other stuff that we do not know where the money comes from. When you go to the ads themselves, they direct you to a website. They don't explain who exactly is financing or who's coordinating the campaigns.
That's all information that, like, you and maybe a lot of people and obviously would want to have. But for people who are looking at just the issue and trying to decide how they feel about this and watching this play out very publicly, it's also very difficult to follow the argument when you have different parts of it that seem to be untrue.
Right, and I think that's the whole bottom line here. The reality check is that for the average viewer seeing these ads, how do they tell the difference on who's telling the truth? And I can just tell you that our Nathan Eagle has written extensively, including this article today. We have tried to separate truth from fiction, and all to underscore that President Obama himself may be coming out here. We haven't officially heard the word, but for him to expand this would be a really significant thing, as you know. Native, you know, born here in Hawaii, the U.S. president. It was actually George Bush who first put the monument status there back when he was still in office.
Using the Antiquities Act.
Exactly. So this is a big deal, and it involves a lot of important players. You're seeing folks like William Isla, for example, featured in this pro ad. You can watch the ad, by the way, on our website. We did post it.
Thanks very much, Chad. It's going to continue. Don't we know that?
Yes, it is.
But
thanks,
maybe
Beth,
we'll see what happens if the president makes his announcement and then what happens as we move through the conference in the next couple of weeks. Talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check. Imagine you live in, say, Kansas City and dream of a Hawaii vacation, one that includes swimming in the ocean with a mammal you've only seen in media or maybe in a zoo. It's a compelling reason that many visitors come to Hawaii, and one promulgated by Hawaii Tourism. But that could change with proposed new rules over the distance ocean swimmers would have to maintain with spinner dolphins to safeguard the dolphins' resting and family time. The proposal was released this week and is now up for public comment, but at its core, the proposal asks a basic question. Should humans seek contact with dolphins? Ann Garrett is the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Protected Resources Division of NOAA's Fisheries Pacific Islands Regional Office, and she's in our studio this morning. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
That idea of seeking out contact with dolphins, because in many ways, generations have grown up with the idea that, you know, dolphins are our friends or could be our friends. There's been movies and TV shows and cartoon characters and all of that. Has that really put dolphins in a very different light and one that we need to demystify?
Well, I think we all enjoy that opportunity and seek that opportunity to better understand our nature. And yes, dolphins are one of those creatures that just hold magical persona for us, and they're very, we associate them with intelligence and social bonding. I think, though, it's still okay to seek out some dolphin experience. It's just a matter of how you go about doing it.
The how of it is usually where we have a lot of, you know, difficulties. How much intrusion into their world. That seems to be at the heart of what these proposed rules are seeking to adjust in our minds, that we really are intruding on an animal's world when we go out to visit, and not just visit, but people who want to actually swim and touch and be part of, particularly at times when these animals are resting or caring for their own young.
That's right. They're beautiful creatures, so we want to have that experience, but we have to remember with the Hawaiian spinner dolphin in particular, they're close to the shore where we are able to see them pretty easily, but they're there for a reason, and that reason is to rest and to nurture their young and to socialize. They are in those areas after a long, hard night of feeding and working together to feed. So they come in and they rest. They're getting away from predators. They're looking for a safe, quiet environment.
When you say they're coming in to socialize, you mean with each other, not us.
With each other, that's right.
For a while, tourism companies have been bringing people to go see the dolphins. I mean, there are whale watches, but not necessarily people getting super close to them, obviously. But with a dolphin that seems so approachable, you know, not huge in size, and for all the reasons that we've talked about, that they're so alluring and compelling, and some would think, you know, adorable, they're also wild animals. I mean, have we not gotten the point across that these are, in fact, wild creatures? I mean, you wouldn't run off and try to pet a wild cat, you know?
Yeah, that's
a
good point.
As a lion.
I think sometimes we do tend to forget that, yes, they're wild animals, and so they can also behave erratically, and it might not be in our best interest. We could get injured, but we don't tend to think of dolphins that way. They're smaller cetaceans. They're closer to our own size. They are often very curious animals, and they often appear to be smiling at us. So we internalize and think that they're happy to see us. But in fact, they're there doing their own thing, and we need to be mindful of that.
So we tend to anthropomorphize a little more than
Absolutely.
We should be doing with these creatures. There are companies, though, who say, but hey, this is our livelihood, and what harm really are we doing? And others who have said, okay, we're maintaining some voluntary guidelines of maintaining that, you know, that distance between our tourists and these creatures. And yes, there are provisions in case one decides to swim over and gets curious about you, but, you know, from the get-go, we're going to keep people away. Has this really become as polarized internally as it appears externally with these companies?
Well, you know, preliminary feedback is very supportive for NOAA taking this action. We have, for a better part of 5 years, operated what we have called our Dolphin Smart Program, where operators have voluntarily signed on to the program, and they operate within the guidelines of a 50-yard distance. They also don't put swimmers in the water, and they also don't advertise with people in close proximity to the dolphins. Those operators are, and others that operate in a similar fashion, are excited about these rules because it's going to level the playing field. There are a few folks that are out there that are just getting too close, and they are chasing down the dolphins, and that's when it becomes a real problem. You can still, because these folks have been in business for a better part of 5 years or more, you can still have a viable business and offer some really rewarding opportunities to view these animals from a distance of 50 yards or greater. In particular, with the spinner dolphin, they're actually known for their acrobatics, and so they'll leap out of the air, out of the water, into the air, and they'll spin 2, 3, even 4 times in the air before they hit the water again. So you can see quite a bit from a vessel.
Which is obviously not something you would be seeing if you were out there necessarily swimming with an animal or seeing as well. So at this point, we're in the public comment period. There are going to be many comments, I'm sure, that you'll see on both sides of this. As you mentioned, that this would be a way to level the, you know, the way in which all of these operators go forward. That's kind of a scary proposition for the ones who have not been doing that and who have been sort of at odds with all of this. Are there going to be any more discussions about, you know, the whys of it and assurances that they can, in fact, have a viable business without necessarily doing what they've been doing?
Well, we're in addition to taking comments electronically and through mail, we are going to have 6 hearings throughout the islands. And so that's our opportunity to come give us their vocal feedback and also have a listen to a presentation, and we'll have an opportunity to just chat about and talk story about what's going on. But we do think that there's an opportunity, and I think many of our supportive operators also think there's a great opportunity to continue to have a good, viable business and take care of the wildlife in a respectable manner.
Which might get you a lot of goodwill and cachet that you can't buy.
That's right.
And Garrett, thank you so much for joining us. We've got the list of those meetings that we'll post on our Facebook page, and we'll be watching this. Not long to watch, right? Because this has got to wrap up by September next year.
That's approximately right. About a year from now, we'll be issuing a final rule.
Ann Garrett is the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Protected Resources Division of NOAA's Fisheries Pacific Islands Regional Office.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Tonight at 5, Bethany will be bringing us Town Square, and those of us who lugged books home all their young lives are somewhat distressed to know that homework's value is now being questioned.
Well, you know, it's been questioned for a while,
yeah,
because of people really wondering if a kid is staying up all hours to get work done and then shows up the next day sleep deprived,
yeah,
and the cycle keeps perpetuating itself, plus all those activities that happen in the afternoon, which are, you know, equal opportunities for learning,
sure,
and important interaction. That really, what are we gaining by homework, and do we need to have a more strategic approach to homework? We saw a Facebook post from a teacher in Texas,
mm-hmm,
you saw this one too, where, you know, she said, look, the only homework I'm going to assign is what we don't finish in school, and that's going to be the driver of trying to maintain, mentioning family time and mentioning the activities,
yeah,
that are important, and trying to create a full life. We talk a lot about, you know, work-life balance for adults. That's also migrated into how parents are looking at their kids' life, too. But
sure,
they want them to do well in school. And so how do you find that kind of balance? We're going to talk a lot about homework tonight.
Well, you know, and the after-school activity thing has really expanded as well. So there's a lot at play here.
That's a whole other conversation.
Exactly.
We could have that one, too. But tonight we're going to talk about the place of homework in your child's life, and we hope to hear from you too. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi everyone, this is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. I spoke with an important local philanthropist, Maisie Sanford. She and her family have a long history of generously giving support when it was needed. I asked Maisie how it all began.
Well, both sets of my great-great-grandparents came originally as missionaries, so they had that helping people thing in mind.
How does it make you feel when you donate?
Very good. I mean, I don't do it to make myself feel good. I do it because I want to, and then afterwards, I'm happy I've done it.
Then I asked Maisie to give an example of her family's philanthropic adventures.
An example was Kalaupapa with the Hawaiians that were isolated there. Both my Smith and my Baldwin ancestors, actually, they took interest in the place, not just donating money, but they occasionally visited. I don't know what motivated them, but they just wanted wanted to help people that needed help.
This was the remarkable Maisie Sanford sharing just a hint of her benevolent mind. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Good to hear Maisie Sanford's voice. You might remember that we lost her this past February. Now, going off to today's backyard quiz, we mentioned there's a wool farm that has nothing to do with sheep. This Big Island farm breeds English Angora rabbits. Now, you might struggle to imagine an animal the size of a rabbit growing enough fur to produce wool, but these are no ordinary bunnies. Each Angora can produce about a pound of spinnable fiber every year. Now, that's not bad for a five-pound animal. That fiber is typically turned into yarn, but can also be found in wool clothing. The rabbits are typically shorn 3 to 4 times a year with no harm coming to them. In fact, if you look up some pictures of an unshorn Angora rabbit, you might see why they actually could appreciate a regular haircut. If you want to see some in real life, you can head over to the Hillside Farm. It's called Hillside Farm Hawaii in Honoka'a.
And Beth Ann, we did have a caller, Sandy from Manoa, who knew the answer to that. So she'll be getting a T-shirt. And at 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
If the sustainable agriculture movement is to succeed, and there's every reason to believe it's doing just that, it has to succeed on the ground level in individual communities. In Pu'unene, Maui, the nerve center is the Hali'i Maile Community Garden, which has more than 100 plots of land available. Lori Feroldi is the secretary treasurer and one of the volunteers who keep it going. She's on the line from there. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Chris.
And when I say volunteers who keep it going, that's quite a few people, isn't it?
It takes quite a few people to keep it going, yes.
How many would you estimate in your community up there?
We have about 60 people right now that are working on it and 3 full-time staff volunteers.
And what's the work of the staff volunteers? What kind of things do they do in the course of their day?
Mainly the standard management, you know, things like as secretary treasurer, I take care of the banking and paying the bills and that sort of thing. Our president takes care of.
Lori, I can barely hear you. Can you get a little closer to your phone?
How's that?
Much better.
Okay.
What were you saying?
I was saying that mainly we take care of normal business operations. For example, paying the bills that we have, the water bill and things like that that come in, handling any issues that arise, you know, repair and maintenance of the equipment and supplies.
Sure.
And things like that.
Well, just using the water bill as an example, but does everybody chip in on that, or how does that work?
Everybody pays a fee. It's $100 a year that they put in towards the pool that then gets paid out to the landscaper and the water bill, and everything else we do through grants.
Mm-hmm. And does that manage to keep you afloat? Well, you're still in existence, right?
It does. We try to keep the cost affordable for everybody so they can participate. So we keep it at a bare minimum, just enough to pay the water bill, and we monitor, you know, our usage closely.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of things are people growing there?
We have lots of bananas and papayas. Some of our community grows things like taro, cassava, and that sort of thing. And then, of course, we have all the standard vegetables, lettuce, kale, chard, onions, carrots, beets, that sort of thing.
What kind of terrain? I'm trying to visualize where you are in terms of elevation and rainfall and soil and things like that.
We're actually right behind the neighborhood in Hali'i Maile, so we get quite a bit of rainfall, not as much as Haiku, but enough, but not too much. We do get a lot of sun up there, so it's kind of really perfect conditions for growing most things. It doesn't get cold enough to do things like apples, but we have a real good climate for growing most everything year-round.
How many growing seasons do you get?
Pretty much two, I would say. There's the winter season where things like spinach will grow better than they would in the summertime. And then in the summertime, we have the hotter season that things like tomatoes really enjoy and produce abundantly.
Mm-hmm. And do some people come to you who are relatively unschooled in gardening and raising vegetables?
Oh, yes. We get people from all walks of life, people that are full-on experts that have gone to school and studied agriculture, and we have plenty of people that have no idea how to do anything and are just coming in to learn and, you know, have an interest in growing. So, yeah, we get people from all over.
For those people who come in and have an interest in learning, what are the first things that they need to sort of understand?
Well, usually we talk about the terrain a little bit, the climate, because the first thing, if they're starting a garden, that they're going to need to understand is how to set up their plot and how to set up the irrigation in their plot, because that's kind of a basic that you need to decide on before you start planting.
Mm-hmm.
So we usually talk about how to amend the soil. You know, like in our climate, we're very close to eucalyptus trees surrounding our property, so we need to add lots of compost. Usually we use manure and also lime, which is, we use calcium or dolomite for that purpose. And that helps to offset the magnesium that the eucalyptus puts into the soil so that the plants can uptake the nutrients. So we talk about
again,
like that.
Laurie, I'm losing your voice. You tend to trail off at the end of a sentence. But you were saying that the magnesium comes from eucalyptus trees. What is the effect of that on the soil?
When there's eucalyptus present, it puts more magnesium into the soil. And you need a balance of calcium and magnesium for healthy plant life so they can uptake the other nutrients. So because we're around a lot of eucalyptus, we have to make sure that we routinely put more calcium into the soil, and we do that through dolomite or oyster shell flour is another good source of calcium. And, you know, most farmers call that lime. You're adding lime to your soil.
But and it looks as if your emphasis is clearly on natural sources, right, rather than
yes,
chemical fertilizer.
Yes, we do everything organically, and we do sustainable agriculture. So the things that we use, we try to use to improve the health of the soil,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, improves the health of the plants and then reduces pesticide use and that sort of thing, which a lot of people are very interested in now.
It sounds as if there's a fair amount of science that people need to understand going in, that there might be a surprise to a novice how much they need to know.
Sure. You know, there's a lot of different things that you encounter, different plant diseases that you have to pay attention to. And, you know, none of us really know it all. If we see the leaves turning yellow on an eggplant, we may not truly understand what's causing that. And we need to do some research and look into the science and find out what the potential causes are and then work on treating it so that we can grow healthy eggplants.
I would think for a lot of the people working together that you might run into a problem, be able to ask the person in the adjoining, but there's a lot of shared information, I would think.
Yes, there is, and that's one of the wonderful aspects of being part of a community garden is that you do have a base of the community as a knowledge resource. So, you know, if there is something going on, chances are your neighbors encountered the same issue and has some tips for you. So it really helps narrow down the time that it takes to resolve, you know, pest issues and disease issues.
You know, I'm in looking at your website and the different things you're growing, I'm startled by the variety. There are a few things I would have expected, the things that you mentioned, but it's really quite a wide range here, isn't there?
There is, and, you know, a lot of people like to experiment with different things. One of the things that was in our newsletter recently was the Kiwano melon. And it's also known as the African horned melon, and it's this big, long melon shaped like a cucumber that has horns on it, and the inside looks like a cucumber. And it's kind of a tart sweet fruit that we've just started growing at the garden. And these are not things that you would normally see in your farmer's market or your grocery store. So it's kind of fun to have an opportunity to get to try and experiment with different things. There's more varieties of corn, for example, than we even know exist. We know of blue corn and yellow corn in the stores, but there's all kinds of multicolored corn and red corn and golden corns. It's just amazing the variety of things that we can grow, and that's what's really fun about gardening is getting to experiment and try and taste all these unique vegetables.
Well, I'm going to look for those African horned melons with some degree of alarm, but it sounds pretty interesting.
They are kind of scary looking, but they're very tasty.
So, sounds good, Laurie. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lori Feroldi is the secretary treasurer of the Hali'i Maile Community Garden on Maui, which is holding a two-hour community activity day Saturday, August 27th at 10:30 a.m. And you can find out how to sign up through our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Beth Ann, I've had a chance to observe the community garden movement a great deal in Vermont, where the climate is anything but hospitable to growing seasons, but the community enthusiasm really carries these kind of places along.
It's become a place where, you know, the community convenes in many ways.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of those places where you can see and visit, share stories, and feel like you are, in fact, part of a community.
Yeah.
That, at least, is one place where we can all plan to go if you don't have a garden of your own.
That's right.
That's it for this Thursday. I'm going to see you later on for Town Square, where we're going to talk a lot about homework. In the meantime, we've got a plan for tomorrow.
Yes, we're going to have a musical tour of Latin America live in our studio.
And you can call us or talk to us anytime you like. Our talkback number is 792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like Facebook, we're there at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past show, you can find them in podcast form under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.